Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. I'd like to invite you to join me for a pilgrimage tour to France this September. It's based on my book, St. Benedict and St. Therese, The Little Rule and the Little Way. I'll be teaching about the spiritualities and the lives of these two great saints, and we'll be visiting the great monastery of Fleury, where St. Benedict's relics are venerated, and of course going to Lisieux to visit the childhood home of St. Therese, the Carmel where she was a nun, and the great basilica dedicated to her honor. But there's more than that. At Paris, we'll be visiting the Basilica of Sacré-Cœur, Rue de Bac with the Miraculous Medal, going on to Vézelay, Nevers with St. Bernadette, Paray-le-Monial, where the devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus was given to St. Margaret Mary, and then Chartres Cathedral, Mont-Saint-Michel, the Normandy beaches, and more. I think there's not only going to be time for instruction and learning, but also prayer and worship, celebrating Mass in the various locations, and also time for fellowship and a good bit of French food and wine, too. Come and join us this September. If you'd like to know more, go to CatholicHeritageTours.com. That's CatholicHeritageTours.com, or be in touch with me through my website, DwightLongenecker.com.
Fellowship and love.
Good evening to you. Welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio 980 in your dial. Welcome. Glad to have you here tonight, bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. We are here tonight, as usual, from 10 to 11 p.m. Glad you could join us. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meet. And tonight, ladies and gentle things, my special guest is Mr. John Tudorus. John, welcome to Beneath the Surface again.
Hello, hello, hello.
How are you, Mr. John?
Feeling good, feeling good.
And John just received his master's degree in philosophy. Congratulations, Mr. John.
Yes, and it took a long time. But I'm done.
Took a long time. You're done. You're relieved and you're happy.
Yes. And then I actually just started today for a new one.
For a new master's degree, that is.
Yes.
And another a subject. Wow. That is awesome. Just continue.
Yeah.
You know? Continue learning.
Well, otherwise I get in trouble, so I have to do something
productive. I see. Yeah. Well, welcome to the ranks of the masters.
Yes. Yes. And if I'm to be like Socrates, I'm a master of nothing.
At least, yes.
I know nothing, so therefore I'm a master of nothing.
As he would say, as Socrates would say, it is the foolish who believe they are wise and the wise who know they're foolish.
Yes,
or something like that.
Yes.
Or it is the wise that know that they know nothing, and fools believe that they're experts.
That too.
That too. 978-454-4980 is our phone number here at Beneath the Surface Radio. 978-454-4980. John, can you notice that my voice is hoarse tonight? Because I don't know if they notice it.
I don't know if they would notice it.
Okay, good.
But you did mention it.
But I won't tell them.
No, don't tell them.
Since they can't notice it,
yes,
I won't tell them.
We don't want to break the fourth wall.
I am a little bit under the weather tonight, so... Stick by me in my voice, but I don't think it's all that different. John, tonight we have a very important topic to discuss. And that is, and we entitled tonight's show the following. Quote, "Much information, little understanding, and no wisdom. Formal education and the closing of the human mind." Unquote.
Can I say it five times fast?
Yes.
I don't know if I can say it one time fast. That's a
lot.
No.
Well, I certainly wouldn't have memorized it. I'm reading it in front of me.
Oh, nice.
"Much information, little understanding, and no wisdom." Then there's a colon. "Formal education and the closing of the human mind."
Hmm.
978-454-4980 if you want to get in on our on this topic or any topic that you would like to choose beneath the surface with us. It is certainly our pleasure to have you come along for the ride tonight. Okay, John, do you want to delve right into this topic, or do you want to say anything else about any current topics that are going on or anything going on in your life?
Well, we already covered the big thing. That was last weekend. Well, I suppose, actually, your title, because I know we were kind of tossing around the title for the show, but actually got me to thinking about why Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro seem to be somewhat popular. And
why is that?
I don't know. I mean, I think your topic title kind of hints on it a little bit. Are you familiar with Jordan Peterson?
I'm familiar with Ben Shapiro.
Okay. Yeah, Jordan Peterson was the... So, Ben Shapiro, of course, is a... he has his own radio show, Daily Wire. He writes pieces for that. A little bit of a child prodigy, literally. But he seems to be also popular on the college-speaking circuit, too.
Yeah.
Because he, as his motto says, facts don't care about your feelings. He's looking to give it to people as straight as possible. Mm-hmm. And it seems that he's found a pretty decent audience for that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think just his statement there, facts don't care about feelings, is certainly a foundation of what we're going to be talking about tonight, in that it seems like everything is based on feelings today, even education. And which is really bizarre, and to the educational establishments, and so we're going to be talking about a little bit about that, a little bit about how even since I was a kid, a formal education had already turned into an information gathering session, of the teacher throwing information at you, and you either taking notes or memorizing it or in. And the goal in the educational establishment was to memorize the terms and spit them back on an exam so that you can get a good grade. And then, of course, when you do that solely, you obviously or inevitably forget about what you learned, because you never really had any understanding or context of what you learned. You just memorized. And so you spit it back, you get a good grade, and you go on. And it seems like, and I'm simplifying it to the extreme, but it seems like this is what education was. Throw out information at you, memorize it, try to get a good grade, move on, you've done it, all of a sudden, you know, eventually you get your diploma, and you feel like you accomplished something when you really haven't.
I've actually experienced a lot of that myself, too, and not just, going all the way up from K through 12, but also even in college, too. I mean, I can't tell you...
All my undergrad was like that.
Yeah. How many classes did we take where just basically memorizing stuff enough to take the test, get our halfway decent grade, and then... But you ask us a month later, and would we actually know much about what was discussed? The answer would be no.
I don't think I went through much thinking in college. I mean, well, in the classroom, in the formal classroom, until I was in graduate school. That's how virtually worthless everything was before graduate school.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say virtually worthless, maybe mostly worthless. You can search the clothes for loose change. No, but I mean, I think there's what we're seeing is a, shall we say, a shell of what perhaps was ideally meant to be. So there is a place for memorization, that is for sure, right?
Well, important facts need to be memorized eventually.
Exactly, but it's not as a standalone, and that's really the key.
And not only that, I don't even know if it's natural just to memorize terms and then talk about them. Eventually, when you get used to them and you understand what's going on and you understand the context and you've wrestled with the material, eventually you will memorize these things.
Well, that's a much more organic way of doing it.
Yeah, it's an organic way of doing it, and it makes sense to the way that the mind is structured.
Yeah, I would I would say my experience definitely proves that to be true.
It seems to me that 90% of what is being taught in public schools today is like force-feeding somebody who's not hungry. There's no curiosity. There's no willingness to sacrifice for the sake of the love of truth. And people are being force-fed information, and they have learned not how to get an education and truly understand and become wise and virtuous, but rather they have learned the technique of knowing what the professor wants, memorizing the particular terms, and getting a good grade on an exam. That's what education, in a nutshell, seems to have devolved into.
Using a broad brushstroke, I would agree with your pulse taking, if you will. And it's not to say that there isn't a certain passion going on for learning certain subjects. I experienced that myself. But I think the key thing was in your comment there was on the part of wisdom, because that's the part that's really missing, that underlies everything. And if there's not enough given in the fertile ground when people are younger, it's much harder for that to be fostered, I think, when people get older.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about when we come out of the womb, because we begin life, we begin life questioning. We begin life in wonder.
Oh, sure.
I mean, just look at the eyes of a child, and just look at what they do as soon as their brain develops enough to have some kind of consciousness.
They stare at you no matter where you go in the room. Their eyes are locked on you.
Yeah, and as soon as they begin to learn the language, after mama and dada, and maybe the word no, the first word we humans say, actually there are two of them, what and why.
Yes, what's that?
What's that? I remember my sister carrying my little baby nephew around the kitchen, and he would just go with his finger like this and point at things, like on the refrigerator and the cabinet. What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? And then, you know, my sister would try to, you know, explain it. Well, this is a this and this is a that. And of course, the baby didn't really understand, but the baby was curious. And as soon as they begin to their wonder develops a little bit in childhood, the word why very often replaces the word what. And you want to know why something is. What is its cause? What is its purpose? And this wonderful wonder, if you will, this curiosity about life, about reality, about existing, that children, that we begin with as human beings, is not fostered by the world. Very often it's not fostered by the family. It's certainly not fostered by the educational system. And it's sort of cleansed or beaten out of you by the time you're an adolescent.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, it's, I would say off and on, it's been like this throughout recorded human history, as far as we know. I mean, in so much as that even when you go back to the ancients, people like Aristotle, and they would recognize that a lot of, in fact, most people, by the time they get to adults, very few of them actually want to contemplate the higher things.
Now, that doesn't make any sense to me at all, because babies, we begin life with those kinds of big questions.
Yeah, we do.
We want to know what's going on.
It's part of it's part of our potential, and you're right. It's very clear that it's very common to ask these questions when we're younger. So why does that sense of wonder seem to go away when people get older?
That's the question.
Yes, it is.
That is the question. And it seems like the big, and let's talk about what the big questions are, because these are the questions that they're the pink elephants in everybody's living room. That children are keen on. They want to know these things. Adults, not so much. And that is, what or who am I? Where am I going? What is expected of me? What happens to me after death? And is there a God? And why does anything exist? I mean, all of those questions need to have some kind of satisfying answer for our minds to understand what's going on here.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that. So I suppose one symptom or one thing that seems to be the case is that the ground is not made fertile enough when children are younger. And, okay. I recall not even just someone like Aristotle recognized this, but even people like Hitler, for example, recognize that when children are young, they're moldable.
Yes.
What was that? Somewhat chilling because we knew his intent, but that comment from him, give me any child under the age of 5 and I will mold him into what I wanted him to be. And that's, I'm loosely paraphrasing here, but the idea is that when a child is young enough, they're very much like a sponge, and if you give them the right stuff, so if you give them the good stuff, you can produce these, it's almost like you're unlocking a lot of the potential that's in there, stuff that's naturally there, and then you're giving it the right fertilizer, the right environment, and before you know it, these kids, even at an earlier age, are pondering and learning things that many adults don't even get to.
All right, we're going to get to more on this question about formal education and the closing of the human mind, and talk more about what is true food for the human mind, and how do we truly attain happiness. 978-454-4980, our phone number. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here on WCAP. Paul Morano here with my guest this week, Mr. John Tutoris. And you, so don't go away. Right after this, we'll be right back. We are back. Back are we. Glad you could join us beneath the surface. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. Guest tonight on Beneath the Surface is Mr. John Tutoris. And we're talking about formal education and the closing of the human mind. Now, John, we haven't even began talking about the propaganda that is now being taught to children throughout the country. We'll save that for the second half of the show. But we were talking before the break about fertile ground, in that we are ignoring the big questions on what it means to be human and what is expected of us and how to attain the greatest good, which is happiness. And I think we were about to say that we have substituted all of those very important questions that people used to ponder, at least some people, with more practical questions about how do I make my next dollar? How do I feed my family?
Sure, that's very common. I remember thinking that myself in school. Am I going to need this in the real world? Now, of course, that's not a bad question to ask. What's of course missing in it is that the vision that's behind that question is often very limited. It's thinking, will this help me make a dollar? Really,
and yeah.
But what it's,
right.
What it's missing underneath the radar is that if my mind is formed, whether or not I make a dollar, I will actually be more adaptive and more able to make do with what I have, whether I have money, whether it's skills, putting things to use.
So, in other words, we've turned materialistic in as much as we believe that money equals happiness, and therefore everything you do, including in school, is for the end goal of making money.
To a certain degree, yes.
And to what Peter Kreeft calls the addictions to security and to comfort.
Yes, and the funny thing, not in the ha-ha funny, but the interesting thing is that it actually causes us to fall short of those very same goals. If I want to be more secure in the world, I would actually be better served if my mind was unlocked to explore these bigger questions. Because in pursuing these bigger questions...
But why is your mind locked? See, that's my problem. How did it ever get locked? I mean, we start life with these questions.
We do.
And the more our minds mature, the more mature these big questions are meant to be. Why are they locked out?
Some is the preoccupation with the here and now, and some of that's understandable, right? There is a natural concern with putting bread on the table, so to speak, making sure that we're fed, we have a roof over our heads, that if we have people we're taking care of, that they're taken care of. And so those are certainly practical concerns and should not be ignored. But the problem is when that's the only thing that's the ceiling of what we think are the big questions. Because if that's the ceiling, then we're actually missing the point.
Well, actually, I think it's the ceiling because I think people have been conditioned to think that there aren't any bigger questions other than how do I make more money, buy a bigger house, and add more security to my life.
And then if someone asks them, they'll say,
Financial security, that is.
They might jokingly say, well, that's above my pay grade. Meaning that I really don't want to expend any time or energy exploring this.
All right, so let's get back to when we were babies and the what and the why question.
Yeah.
Now, the what is life? And hence, what is the purpose of my life? Which equals, actually, why am I here? How do you begin to answer those big questions?
Well, you can start in a natural fashion with the natural world, but inevitably someone is going to fall short. If that's all they consider, they have to consider our whole person. We're not just the material, you know, for, eat, sleep, poop, make babies, you know, proliferate the species.
This is what animals do.
Yes, but we're rational animals.
Yeah, we're
rational animals with an immortal soul by our nature.
We're animals plus.
Animals plus is a very good term, yes. Animals plus.
Can you coin that, by the way? What was that?
Can you coin that?
I suppose I could.
Yeah.
But if we were simply animals, then eating, procreating, and have a comfortable place to put our head is the extent to which would fulfill us. That's all we'd need.
Yeah.
We'd need nothing else.
Except it doesn't.
And it doesn't fulfill us because we're more than animals.
Yeah, there is an emptiness if that's all we focus on.
And there's a heart, there's a soul, there's a mind, whatever you want to call it, that is crying to be fed. And because we block out those big questions today and we fill it with very shallow things in order to get by on a daily basis, we're decreasing or diminishing our humanity. We're saying, let's be more and more like other animals.
Yes, pretty much. Well, let's be less than what we really are.
Yes.
It's ultimately what we're saying. Even if we're not saying it explicitly, implicitly we are.
Now, speaking of Peter Kreeft, who happens to be a great internationally known philosopher and author, and one of my favorite teachers when I was in college, he wrote a book called The Journey. And, John, I want to read from it the 10 questions he says that represents the 10 paths or decisions that we all have to make in life. And it begins like this. Question number one, shall I even question? Shall I go on this quest for truth at all? Let's talk about that one for a second, because that's really what we're talking about here. Should we even ask the big questions, or should we not even bother and just go along with the world? It's a lot easier that way, huh?
It is.
On the surface level?
Willful ignorance, I think, is very common in this world. And I know just even thinking myself, like, when you ask that question, there's a part inside of me that almost says, can I avoid taking the harder journey?
And you know what I think? And in addition to that, because virtually it seems like hardly anyone is taking that journey, that intellectual, spiritual journey, that's... you get along with people more on a shallow level because so many people are living on that level.
Oh, yes.
You'd be able to make more friends and acquaintances, I suppose.
Acquaintances, yeah, not necessarily deep friends.
I think you've got a point there. Okay, so if the answer to that question is yes, I should question. I shouldn't just ignore them, the big pink elephants in the living room. Then we go to question number two, which is this. If I question, is there hope for answers? Or should I be a skeptic? Is there objective truth?
Reality would say there certainly is. If I accidentally stub my toe by kicking a chair in the morning while I'm walking around half blind after waking up, and I say, ouch, and grumble for the next minute or so, that's because I really accidentally kicked the chair and stubbed my toe, and by golly, that hurts.
There's a real chair that's and a real pain.
A real pain.
Despite what you may think about it. So, believe it or not, there are a lot of people, particularly academic types, who would abort the mission on question number two and say, sure, we may begin with these questions in our hearts, but there really are no objective truths. It's just whatever we say is true, or what's true for you is true for you, and for me, and therefore, we'll just stop right there.
Except that they don't really practice that in reality. When they're hungry, they go eat. In fact, when they need to breathe, their body breathes involuntarily for them in order to help promote their survival. Their heart beats without them even desiring it to beat. It's an objective reality that these things happen.
So we live our daily lives expecting that there is objective truth, presuming that there's objective truth all around us, including within us.
Yeah.
And yet, when it comes to these bigger, more important questions, we say that there is none?
And the funny thing is the people who hold those beliefs need to communicate that with words that they give a certain weight and meaning to. So they use an objective, an alphabet with objective meaning to it in order to form these words, to form these concepts.
Right.
And without that, they wouldn't be able to communicate anything.
You know what the bottom line philosophy of these folks here that stop at question two? This is it in a nutshell, and I'll quote, "It is true that there is no truth."
That is a logical contradiction.
That is.
Yeah.
And their philosophy is based simply on contradiction.
Yeah.
All right, so if you're wise enough to realize that you don't want to fall into that contradiction, then you go to question number three, which is this. If there is any objective truth, is there objective truth about the meaning of life?
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
So you can seed the fact that, okay, there are mathematical truths, there are scientific truths, there are some obvious truths that the senses can detect, and so on and so forth. But what about those big questions? Maybe there isn't any objective truth to those more important, bigger questions.
Well, you know, if we have to take the little things in life that we can see in front of us at face value, it would stand to reason that we should also take the big question seriously as well, too, and actually apply very similar, if not the same, logic.
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah, if I'm going to be consistent.
Now, it might take a little longer. It might be a little more arduous.
Sure.
But it would certainly well be worth it.
Well, yes, and one reason why it takes a bit longer and it's a bit more arduous is because we can't necessarily see, taste, touch, interact with these big questions. So when we ask, why do I exist? What is the meaning and purpose of my life? I can't touch it. I can't taste it. I can't feel it. But what I can do is I can interact with the material things. And with that, it helps form a certain base of logic. And then those tools of reason that I use in interacting with the world, if I'm consistent, I start to extrapolate and then apply those to the bigger questions.
So, in other words, you follow reason, you follow your mind to where it takes you.
Exactly.
And as long as you don't contradict reason, you can trust where your mind takes you.
Exactly. So it's not necessarily an easy journey, but it's actually a doable journey. And that's the important thing. It's very doable.
So then you would say yes to question number three.
Yes, I would.
Okay. And so you're not going to get bogged down there. You say yes to question number three, then that would bring you to question number four, which is interesting. It's this. If there is objective truth about the meaning of life, is it that life is meaningless? Oh, vanity of vanities.
Well, if there is objective truth, by virtue of that alone, I would have to say it is certainly not meaningless.
Okay. So if there is an objective truth about why we exist, then there must be true meaning to this life, is what you're saying.
Oh, yes, there is.
There has to be. Okay. Then let's. Then you would say yes to question number four, which brings you then to question number five. If life has real meaning, is it spiritual and not merely material?
Ooh.
That's question number five for all of our lives that we need to ask.
And when we say, is it spiritual, not merely material, we're effectively saying, is it both?
Yeah, merely. Yeah, yes. He's not saying, is it spiritual or material? He's saying, is it spiritual and not merely material?
Right. it's certainly a both and. We are holistically both material and spiritual, all rolled in one.
So in other words, when we're trying to find the meaning to our lives, we can't simply stop at what we see, the material, or else we'll never be satisfied.
Exactly. And really, if we say, well, why can't we stop at that? Well, then just take one quick step back and say, well, isn't it interesting that I'm able to think ideas and think about things, and there's no material in that, and yet I don't doubt that my mind works.
Yeah, you can't touch, taste, smell, hear ideas.
Yeah.
They exist, though, because you have them.
Exactly.
And you have thoughts, and you can grasp concepts. You're grasping an immaterial object when you're grasping a concept, which means that there must be something immaterial in you to be able to grasp something immaterial like a thought or a concept.
The evidence would certainly point that this is very organic to our nature. Getting back to what we mentioned earlier on the show, the kid who asks why and what all the time. I mean, such an early age, they're 2-3 years old, they start pointing at things. Doggy, kitty cat, tree, sky,
and it's interesting,
car, and they're abstracting these ideas in their mind.
They're abstracting the concepts, or else the word what makes no sense to a non-human being. Because if you are an animal and you go up to a refrigerator, you're going to sniff it. If you can't eat it, you'll pass it by. It's simply a physical object to you for utilitarian purposes. There is no what or meaning to the object. And yet, human beings point at it and want to know what it is and why it is. Meaning and purpose. This is very human to want to know these things. It's almost like to the physical, what food and water is to the person, meaning and purpose is to the mind.
That's some deep thoughts there, Paul.
That's what I'm here for, John.
All right. Woohoo! I'm ready.
All right. So then, here we are on our question number six. Excuse me. Question number five. You would say yes. There. Let's see. How was the question? If life has real meaning, is it spiritual and not merely material? So you would say no to the philosophy of materialism, like we just said.
Yes.
That there is more than simply material, including in the human person themselves. And so you would then not get bogged down and stop and abort your mission at question number five. You would continue.
I would.
So let us continue to question number six. If the meaning of life, if it is spiritual, is it moral? Or is there a real right and wrong? So does the meaning of life have anything to do with morality?
That is a good question. So here it's moving beyond just what is our nature, spirit and matter, but then saying, okay, well, is there a right or wrong way to do things?
Well, that's part of our nature, because if we do things the right way, we will attain our fulfillment and happiness.
Ooh, so, happiness.
Yeah, so morality has everything to do with our nature.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
All right. We're on question number... What are we on? Question number... six. We've got four more to go after this. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. That's what we're doing here. We're delving beneath the surface on the question of formal education and the closing of the mind. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. Be back right after this. Don't go away. And we're back. 978-454-4980. Paul Morano here with my hoarse voice.
Wilbur.
and trying to get over something. I don't know what I have, but whatever it is, hopefully it'll be gone before Friday because, John, I have a gig Friday night. I've got to be singing and playing.
Ooh.
Yeah. With my one-man musical, whatever it is.
Yes. Do you play the drums and the guitar and the kazoo all at once?
Once in a great while, the kazoo.
Oh, that is actually pretty neat.
Yes, but guitar and sing, oldies but goodies and originals. But that is not going beneath the surface. So let us go back to beneath the surface here at 978-454-4980. And we're talking about information but little understanding, knowledge but no wisdom, formal education and the closing of the human mind. And we've been talking about how education seemed to, at least public education and formal education, if you will, for many people has devolved into an information gathering service to get a good grade at a school so you can get into a good college. And the same thing happens there, so you can get a decent job, so you can be comfortable and secure, and then die. There is very little to do with thinking, reasoning, understanding, and becoming a wise human being. That was very important in pre-modern times. Not so much lately where we focus more on utilitarian things and ends and materialistic ends, like we talked about earlier in the first segment. So, John... Formal education has, again, become utilitarian and not for the sake of understanding and wisdom. And we were going through the introduction to The Journey, written by Dr. Peter Kreeft, a world-renowned philosopher. And he says that we're all on a journey, every single one of us. We can't avoid it. And in this journey, there are 10 important questions, 10 elephants in the room, if you will, that we need to confront in order to have any kind of satisfaction or happiness in this life, or any inner peace. And we've already mentioned 5 of the questions. I'll just go over them really quickly.
I think we, just before the break, we hit number 6, was it, on morality?
Let's repeat the questions. Number 1 is, shall I even bother asking the big questions? Number 2 is, if I do ask, are there hope for answers? Or is there no objective truth? Number 3 is, if you say yes to that, number 3 is, if there is objective truth, is there objective truth about the meaning of life? That big question. And if you say yes to that, you go on to 4, which is, if there is any objective truth about the meaning of life, is it that life is meaningless? Oh, vanity of vanities, as he quotes part of the Bible. But if you have faith and trust that there is more, then you go on to question 5. If life really does have real meaning, not just what we say it is, but real objective meaning, is it spiritual and not merely material? So in question 5, John, you adaptly argued as to why it has to be spiritual as well as material, because the physical, we're more than animals, and everything that is physical, the hedonistic lifestyle does not satisfy. And so we went on to question 6. Well, if the meaning of life is spiritual, is it moral? And is there a real right and wrong? And this, John, has to relate to what is becoming more and more popular in our culture, pop culture today, and that is moral relativism. Is there a real right and wrong?
That's just quicksand waiting to happen if we stick around with more relativism. Just like the person who doesn't believe that there's an objective truth as far as the material reality of the world.
Yeah.
If you try and extrapolate that over to the moral realm, if people actually act it out. So even when people say they believe in that, they really don't act that way for the most part. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that we are social beings.
Yeah.
And whether or not we recognize it, if we go into the danger zone, our body, it's almost like this social survival thing, mechanism in us, I think, that actually stops us to some degree. But not completely, right?
Hmm.
So in private, we might do moral wrongs. And it's not, even if we do it in private, it does affect us in the social realm, too.
No so, question. I mean,
nothing happens in a vacuum, for sure. And even if it's something where, say, well, no one's going to be materially affected by this thing that I do, well, it affect, for one thing, is it affects our behavior and how we interact with others.
Yeah.
Right? Our internal disposition is changed.
Yeah. So morality has everything to do with us being happy and making or leading others to happiness.
Yeah. It's almost like an internal justice, right?
Yes.
Getting things rightly ordered.
Correct.
Just as like there's a right orderedness to the way a society might function in things, there's a right orderedness to the interior of a person.
So just like radical skepticism is based on a contradiction, which is, quote, it is true that there is no truth, unquote. Of course, that's a contradiction. So too is this, relativism, based on contradiction, basically saying it is good to believe that there is no objective good.
My eyeballs were crossed when you said that one.
So skepticism is to truth what relativism is to goodness.
Yeah.
And you right here will say, of course there is a real good and evil.
Yes, there is.
It is objective, regardless of my opinions or what I believe or anything else. And in order to attain happiness, we need to discover what that is. What those behaviors are that leads to it, and act accordingly.
Oh, absolutely. And I would say it's a good thing to uncover these things because it's like a roadmap, you know, to help us
exactly.
get... Like, so if I recognize about myself that that I have certain faults that are damaging not just to myself but to others, then understanding that will actually give me sort of the roadmap. So that if I want to take that journey, I can get out of my own way and maybe help participate in my own cure.
Well, speaking of getting out of your own way, if you say yes to question six, which you just did, there is a real right and wrong. It's not just moral relativism for everybody. Then you go to question number seven, which is this. If there is a real right and wrong, a real moral meaning, is it a religious meaning? Is there a God?
Wow, dude.
In other words, if there is a true moral law, is there a true moral lawgiver?
Reason would say, yes, there has to be. Nothing happens in a vacuum. We can almost dip into one of Aquinas' five ways about the existence of God, and that there's an orderness, there's an intelligibility to the universe. Both locally in what we can see, but also when we look in the cosmos. And that also has to do with our internal disposition too, our own internal justice. So if there's this orderedness that goes on as far as how I ought to conduct myself, both in private as well as in public, then it would seem that that orderedness has an author. Just as paintings don't pop up out of nowhere, they have a painter, sculptors. Sculpture has a sculptor behind it. So, too, does the author of our being.
So, if there is a natural order by which we must discover and conform to in order to be happy, there must be a creator and an author of this order, is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
This moral order to life and this, you know, design of human nature.
Yeah, and what's very fascinating is, and we look back, and probably one of the most famous rules that are given by God for people to follow is the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments, so at first glance, most people would say, well, those are just religious laws. Those are ten don'ts. Don't do this. Don't do that. And what they're really missing is that those are actually part of what we call natural law. It's not just saying, God saying, do this, do this, do this, or don't do that.
It's etched in the human heart.
Exactly. It's in our being. And what God is doing is making present what's already there and saying... Yeah.
Confirming what we already know, in a sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then bringing it out and saying, here's a guide that will actually help you be happy.
Every people, every tribe, every nation on earth has always followed the Ten Commandments in some way or another. They've always regulated those ten words. those ten categories of morality.
Absolutely.
So it is truly etched on the heart. But what's interesting about what we just went through, and I went through seven of the ten questions. For this radio show, it's not necessary to go the next three. But if you don't ignore the elephants in the living room, if you actually follow the questions of your heart that begin in childhood, you will undoubtedly come to its end, which is God.
Yes, you will.
Now, a lot of people would say, well, that's childish to think about God as, first of all, even existing, but second of all, being the answer to everything. But the deeper you think, the more philosophical you think, even the more you follow good science, it all points to what the child already knows. It all points...
It's entirely reasonable.
...to God.
In fact, I would flip that on its head and say it is more childish, as in like a child throwing a tantrum, to not believe in the existence of God. Almost like if I'm a full-grown adult and I have the faculties of my reason, I have a fair amount of education and erudition, and I reject God... There has to be some degree of willful ignorance going on. Reason says that it just doesn't happen.
Was it Nietzsche that once said, I can't stand the idea of there being a God because then I wouldn't be God. So because I can't stand it, then I declare that there is no God.
That sounds like a kid throwing a tantrum.
That's precisely what it is. It's an intellectual tantrum. And it seems like we are... With academia and the media, which are the two mind-molding establishments in our society, we are truly going through a rebellious adolescent period in cultural history.
Yes, and that the rebellious adolescence doesn't know any age boundaries. It goes all the way up until someone is 80, 90, 100 years old.
No question. And the leaders of this are the folks who are supposed to be the experts. You know, the higher-ups. All right, so we've talked about what isn't being taught in schools today.
Yeah.
The important questions about, you know, what it means to be a human being. And therefore, we have all kinds of confusion today sexually, with the difference between sex and gender, which is a whole bunch of nonsense that all the, you know, the so-called elites are pushing on everybody. I don't have to tell you about the amount, the increase in people on meds, suicides, and all the rest of it that go with this confusion of our contemporary times. But not only are they not focusing on the important and big questions in public education and formal education, if you will, but they're also substituting that now. Not just for reading, writing, and arithmetic, like it used to be, but they're substituting it now for ideological propaganda.
Oh, big time, big time. And under the guise that somehow they're current, they're with it, that the logical fallacy that because it's being currently introduced and taught, that somehow it's better than what came before it. And that is a logical fallacy. Just because something is being communicated now doesn't necessarily mean it's true compared to what was communicated prior.
Well, not only that, if you do ignore the big questions, like we've been talking about all show tonight, then you're ignoring the very existence of reality, which is God. And if you ignore God, then you tend to become your own gods. You know, nothing is true in and of itself. Nothing is good. We get to create our own morality. And when that becomes the case, then of course you create your own what it means to be a human being, and you make up all of this nonsense that's going on today, and you spew it to, like you said, formable children.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of it is there's a certain intellectual insanity.
Yes.
I think that's the term that you've used before, but I would certainly agree with it. I'm of the opinion that that some other people who've thought about this prior, before even you and I, had the right answer, and that we need to stand on the shoulders of the giants who came before us, the right giants, right? Not the pretenders, There's, I'm sure you're familiar with the Mortimer Adler. He was an American philosopher and educator. And he thought, this is going back into like the 1920s and 30s. Even then, he recognized that the schooling system was off kilter. At that, even back then, he recognized there were these overpriced trade schools that are just trying to pump out students. And this is like, what, 80, 90 years ago?
Yeah.
And now it's worse.
It's been a two-step process, unfortunately, since they took God out of schools. And that is trying to pump out, like you said, trade school people, people just filled with information but no real wisdom. But that turned into propagandizing people and destroying their souls. To the point where you almost have to say today, if you enroll your child in many of these public school systems, it may be akin to child abuse. And I know that a lot of people are going to say, what the heck are you talking about? Well,
depending upon what they're teaching them, and if isn't
the child's mind and soul at least as important as their body?
I agree.
All right.
I will give my quick parting to the Giants. That I think would need to be introduced to help foster that fertile ground for wisdom as well as truth and knowledge is Aristotle and Aquinas.
Yes.
Without question.
The two A's.
The two A's. Without question.
And the third one, John Tudorus.
Not yet.
Not yet, but soon. Okay, thank you folks for listening. Thanks for putting up with my hoarse voice. And thank you, John, for delving beneath the surface with us again tonight. Interesting topic. A lot of passion on every side of this topic.
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tours Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.